Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, historian and author Kelly Lytle Hernandez sits down with writer Michael Zapata to discuss her book, Bad Mexicans, Race, Empire, and Revolution in the Borderlands. The recently released book fills in one of the largest gaps in our history textbooks, the 1910 Mexican Revolution, which remade both Mexico and the United States. This conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022, at the inaugural American Writers Festival and was recorded live.
Hello, everyone. My name is Noelle Velasco, and I'm one of the program coordinators at the American Writers Museum. I'd like to welcome you all to this program at the American Writers Festival, celebrating the past, present, and future of American writing. Welcome to our partners from the Chicago Humanities Festival, the co-sponsors of this program, and all the CHF members in attendance today. Rebel historian Kelly Lytle Hernandez fills in one of the largest gaps in our history textbooks, the 1910 Mexican Revolution, which remade both Mexico and the United States. Hernandez takes us back to the front lines of the Manganistas, a group of agitators who challenged Mexican dictator Porfirio Diaz. Hernandez's book, Bad Mexicans, uncovers the often overlooked story of a revolution that triggered a demographic sea change in the Mexican-American population, threatened to undo the rise of Anglo-American power and forever change our political landscape. Hernandez is joined in conversation by Michael Zapata, founding editor of Make Literary Magazine and the author of the lost book of Anana Murrow. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, everyone. I'm just beyond ecstatic. And if you haven't seen it yet, but I was so beyond ecstatic to get a copy of this. So I just have a few words before we kind of jump in. I was just profoundly affected by it, as we were kind of talking about a little bit earlier. But if everyone please, I'm going to make my book sales pitch all night here, or all afternoon. But mil gracias to the American Writers Festival and Chicago Humanities Festival and the Cultural Center for hosting. Bad Mexicans is about many things. The run-up and orchestration of the world-shattering Mexican Revolution, a definitive story of the brutal forces of capital, racism, land theft, and labor at the end of the 19th century and the start of the 20th century. The rise of revolutionary journalism and press, but also, very intimately, it's about the lives of workers, Magonistas and revolutionaries, the migrant workers, miners, farm workers, journalists, and indigenous communities who had their land and lives stripped away from them and given to foreign investors as they planned the revolution from the desert borderlands. There are powerful sections and passages throughout about displacement, hunger, oral storytelling, about the pseudonyms and codes used to evade federal agents, about organizing workers brutally killed by mine owners, and about the unspeakable fears, ideological rifts, and tender solidarities that took hold of revolutionaries as they lived their lives together. So this is not a book of poetry. It's not a book of poetry. But in your history of the Magonistas, in the totality of them, there are trembling strings and syllables and events and concepts which I felt like you plucked at again and again, and what emerged is something really beautiful and necessary. So in other words, in Bad Mexicans, I could see and know and deeply feel the lives of these workers and the revolutionaries. It's just absolutely astounding. And thank you for putting something like this into the world. So to make things easy for the first question, what drew you initially to the lives of these revolutionaries and workers?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for that kind introduction and for being here today. So what drew me? I'm from San Diego, California, so I grew up on the border. I'm a borderlander, right? And so what drew me to this story is that, in all honesty, when I was in graduate school, I read about the Magonistas in a book. I was taking a Mexican history course. It was just a couple of paragraphs, but I knew immediately that it was a really epic story. And I knew that it had happened in my hometown, in my home territory, and no one had ever told me the story. How could it be that these ordinary Mexicanos from the borderlands had really taken on both the U.S. government and the Mexican governments, and to a large degree, won, and no one had ever shared that story with me as a young person growing up in this area? So that's what kind of for 20 years drew me to the story, and I was constantly picking up everything that people were publishing in Mexico or in the United States about the Magonistas. And to that point, a lot has been written about them. It's just that it's been stuck in the academy. And so for me, the punchline of this book is to bring this extraordinary, gripping, riveting, powerful tale of ordinary migrant workers, right? Many of them at the time would have been defined as undocumented, taking on some of the most powerful people in the world and winning, and bringing that to a popular audience, a general audience.
Yeah, I was even telling you before, if someone in high school or college had given me a book like this, as opposed to like the Latino story, the Mexican story, the borderland story, I would have felt connected, you know, it, more than just like, not even a footnote, a sentence. You know, if you open up like a college book or intro level freshman book, or even books that we have in history in seventh grade, there's nothing. And you're offering across the board a complex story in which not only people can be seen, you know, Latino, we say thank you for letting us be seen, but to know, which is a completely different thing. There's two people who I saw, I want to make it clear that this is a tour de force of a history book, and you're going to get just the way revolutionaries' lives intersect. We could talk about that itself all night, but I do want to ask about El Alma de Todo. So I do want to ask about Ricardo Flores Magón, because he was almost too pure-sighted, right, in his presentation. Ultimately, an anarchist who falls out ideological rifts with the socialists of his time. But can you sort of paint a picture of Ricardo Flores Magón and how he became sort of the center and the soul of some of this movement?
So that's a great question. So at the center of this story is a young man named Ricardo Flores Magón. And he, you know, he begins as a journalist in Mexico City. And he very carefully begins to challenge the dictatorship in Mexico, first with allegory, right, and metaphors. And by the turn of the 20th century, is really taking on the dictatorship, naming the dictator in Mexico a tyrant, an autocrat, a dictator, calling him a general, right? The general, rather than letting him be known by his favorite moniker, like El Don, the Don, the patriarch of the nation. And so he is a really brave and courageous person. His mind is extraordinarily sharp. He's brilliant. His tongue is his greatest weapon. He's also vitriolic, right? And the way that he can slash against a dictator, he can also turn against some of his closest friends whenever they disagree with him. And as he shifts from being a radical socialist to an anarchist, some people go with him into anarchy and some people remain socialists, and he turns against them in really brutal ways. So he's an anti-hero in some ways, right? He is the person who's brave enough to stand up to the dictator, but he's also the person who can, you know, cut away at some of his greatest friends and allies. So that's the man at the center of this story, and he goes to all ends, right? He's pure, as you say, to the very end, that he refuses to step back or to moderate his ideas at any time. He's incarcerated multiple times in Mexico and the United States. And he never relents. And so he dies being known as, you know, the soul of the revolution, or as a fearless leader that leads Mexico into total all-out armed revolt.
Yeah, and the way I took some of it too, the riffs are pretty critical to the future of Mexico and sort of what happens after sort of the incendiary stages of the Mexican Revolution. This is such a hard question, but why do you think, in some degree, having had spent some time with his letters and with the history of it, why do you think he stayed so pure to anarchy when his friends were saying we could have land distribution, right, if we... the state can offer land distribution, and he was arguing for the abolition of the state. Did you find anything sort of in the historical record or with who he was that you felt kept that fire in him for better or worse, as far as the future of Mexico was? And this is a tricky question, and I'll apologize, everyone, because I am a novelist. So, of course, I'm really curious about, like, tell me about their soul. But what did you feel or find in the historical record as far as why he stayed so pure to anarchism?
That's a really good question, right? And I am a historian, so I'm grounded by the archive in many ways. But I'm going to depart from that a little bit and give you my sensibility of the man. He was an ideologue, right? And so he believed in ideas, and he would follow those ideas to the very end. And one of the things that's important about Ricardo Flores Magón, as the revolution begins to pick up and his movement, the Magonistas, organized 4 armed raids into Mexico from Texas between 1906 and 1908, and I take you into those raids in this book. So they are an applied movement. It's not just a movement of ideas. But Ricardo is always someone who stays back in the United States and refuses to go to the front lines to actually fight. And I think that's part of why he's able to remain in the world of ideas, that he never pushed himself in the world of application, right? Of what does it mean when you turn the ideas into action? Whereas Juan Sarabia, who goes down into Mexico to recruit fighters and ends up getting arrested and imprisoned for multiple years, he's calling Ricardo back when the revolution begins, says, come, help us rebuild Mexico. And Ricardo stays in Los Angeles and really smears Juan as a Judas from turning away from the great ideas of the revolution and being content with modest reforms. So for me, that would be it, is that he refuses to actually engage in the action of revolution. He remains in the world of ideas.
You have to do something with the ideas. And there's so much of a historical record in here of so many of the revolutionaries and workers who sort of caused this eruption. I paused when I read about Teresita. There are places in this where you're only given so much space to touch upon people who have these extraordinary lives. But Teresita was sort of a rebellious healer, the saint of Caborda, who legend holds, as you write, was called by the dictator the most dangerous girl in Mexico. And she appears multiple times throughout this history. And I was wondering, conceptually, Teresita seems for me, she pops up every now and then in this history at the right times, right? And helping thousands and thousands of people, not only with healing. Can you tell us a little bit about Teresita? And also the role that revolutionary women played, and how the revolutionary men at the time also were sort of a product of erasing and not giving them roles that they should have clearly had.
So Teresita is this extraordinary teenager who lives in Sonora, Mexico. And she becomes known as a mystic, as a healer. And people across northern Mexico go to her father's farm to seek healing. And thousands of people claimed to have been healed by Teresita. And she begins to speak out against the regime in Mexico, because she says, so many people are coming to me sick and ill because they're being displaced and dispossessed, and they're wandering and they're harmed, and their health is being hurt by the regime. They can't access water, they can't access food, they're working hard, the conditions are terrible, and most important, they're being displaced, right? Which disrupts communities and community health. And so she begins to speak out against the regime in really tactical ways. And many people across northern Mexico regard her as a saint, right? And so when they challenge the dictatorship, they'll often challenge the dictatorship in her name, right, or being guided by her, whether or not she had a personal relationship with them. And there's an incident that happens in a small town called Tomochich that in the 1890s had challenged the dictatorship, said, we want to have an independent pueblo or town. We want to, declare our fealty to Teresita in particular, not to the Diaz regime. And Porfirio Diaz sends in troops to crush this movement. And it escalates to the point that Diaz's soldiers torch the town and incinerate everybody who lived there, men, women, and children, hundreds of people. And a couple people are able to escape, especially women and children. But Teresita is the person who was able to inspire people to fight the regime to that point, right? Even to the point that they gave their lives in this revolt. And she goes on to continue to inspire many revolutionaries. She has to leave Mexico and come to the United States. She leads a healing tour. She becomes a beauty queen. She leads a healing tour across the United States, an extraordinary history. But as Ricardo Flores Magón and the Magonistas begin to build their social movement, as you say, she pops up from time to time as an inspiration to their movement. So she's more inspirational, and that's the role that she plays in the movement. But there are women in this movement who are, we just talked about being practical and applied, right? Yeah, yeah. Who are moving dynamite and guns across the border for these armed raids in their baby carriages, right? And throwing it under a blanket and smuggling guns back and forth across the border. There are women who, when the rebels are incarcerated in the LA County Jail or elsewhere, who are smuggling correspondence back and forth from the political prisoners inside to the rebel fighters on the outside. And this is a really good story. So there's people like Conchita Rivera and Maria Bruce in Los Angeles. When Ricardo Flores Magón is arrested in LA, he's held there for several years and held in solitary confinement. His lifetime partner and who's the most badass of badass Mexicans ever, Maria Bruce, shows up at the jail and says, I'm here to wash Ricardo's clothes. I just need to do my womanly duty, right? She didn't tell nobody that she had written on small sheets of paper rebel correspondence and sewn it into the seams of his underwear as chonies, right? And was moving rebel correspondence back and forth. And that's one of the ways that she gets out, battle plans, instructions, manifestos, and really helps keep the movement alive while Ricardo Flores Magón is held in solitary confinement. So there's all these women, right? And, it's the archival record for them is very difficult because they often don't write as much or as often as the men. So you really have to listen to their deeds, right? And you have to listen to what is written about them. But when you do that, when you listen to the archive very, very carefully, the women are clearly at the center of this revolution.
And also, like you said, action, doing things that, others wouldn't. And it's just like a catastrophic and transformative experience to read about how Diaz and handing over large swaths of land to capitalists in North America, to those who have sort of a cursory investment and are decimating towns. And so I think sort of to read about that, the ways in which people's homes, like you said, Teresita's home, were just obliterated and disappeared at the hands of a dictator who was beholden to capitalists in Mexico and the United States, it paints this material portrait that I think can be sometimes very lacking in the historical record. I think there's just a level of material acknowledgement to how the lives of the revolutionaries and you can imply our own lives are sort of impacted by when the needs of capital are more than the needs of millions and millions of people in Mexico during this time. In 1985, one of my favorite writers, Eduardo Galeano, he's a Uruguayan writer, sort of obsessed with recapturing the history of Latin American, but he writes in Memory of Fire, which is like an imaginative history. So he attempts to sort of recapture 400 years of Latin American history. He writes, through the centuries, Latin America has been despoiled of gold and silver, nitrates and rubber, copper and oil, and its memory has also been usurped. And he goes on, he says, I'm not a historian. I'm a writer who would like to contribute to the rescue of the kidnapped memory of America. But above all, Latin America, that despised and beloved land, I would like to talk to her, share her secrets, ask of her what difficult clay she was born and from what acts of love and violation she comes. So although Eduardo Galeano is not a historian, I felt like a deep solidarity between his work and your work and how you in Bad Mexicans and how you are sort of rescuing this kidnapped memory of the revolutionaries and rescuing this kidnapped memory of Latinos in the borderlands. And so I kept thinking like this just deep solidarity between this novelist and yourself and the ways both setting out to recapture a lost history, a lost narrative, or I should say a purposely destroyed one. So I'm really, 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 really curious because he also says, from the outset, Latin American history has been condemned to amnesia by those who have prevented it from being. And so I'm so fascinated, I'm so curious, as a historian, how do you envision memory itself? How do you envision this idea of when you go to the record, when you go to sort of the oral tradition, when you go to the historical record, when it's first person accounts, and you are sort of face to face with memory itself? And so I've always wanted to ask a historian like yourself, like how do you envision memory, and how do you contend sort of with forced amnesia, politically forced amnesia by capital that has essentially attempted to erase stories that you then set out to recover? What does that look like as a historian?
Well, that's a really powerful question. So let me begin with this. This is not a forgotten story, right? In Mexico, the story, I'll speak a little louder, is very well known. In fact, the Mexican government in January declared this year, 2022, to be the year of Ricardo Flores Magón, right? Yes. There are memorials everywhere. He is part of the canon. The movement is part of the canon. It is a very, very well-known story / legend / history and memory in Mexico. But that kind of stops at the border, right? And we, although, you know, the vast majority of their movement actually happens in the United States and has great consequences for the United States, we don't know the story here. And for me, the question is, why does that memory or that history stop at the border? And this doesn't mean nobody knows the story. There are certainly, especially sort of radical Latino organizing communities that know the Magonistas very well. But I'm talking about the canon, the mainstream history. For me, one of the points of this book, and I think I'm going to go back in a minute and talk a little bit more about the book, because who here has had a chance to read it? It just came out. Yeah, so I think we need to step back and tell them a little bit more about the book.
Yeah.
But the point of writing this book, I began it when a certain president declared Mexican immigrants to be bad hombres, right? I said, well, I know another autocrat who once called Mexican migrants fighting to build a better life for themselves, bad Mexicans, right? And the history, the racial violence that Trump was summoning by using that rhetoric, and that it was something we couldn't really understand. We knew it was bad, right, to call a group of people bad hombres, but we didn't really understand what he was summoning, and that's because of the amnesia, the lack of knowledge about Latino history or Mexican-American history in particular in the United States. Mexican-American studies was until recently, illegal in Arizona and many other places. If you go into your typical textbook, there's almost nothing on Latinx history or Mexican-American. I'll speak in terms of Mexican-American history in terms of this book. There's almost nothing. When I was selling this book to some, you know, huge publishers, people who read everything, people were time and time again were like, we didn't know any of this. More than 500 Mexicans were lynched in the United States. We didn't know any of this. Mexicans and Mexican Americans were subject to something akin to Jim Crow, this thing called Juan Crow across the Southwest. We didn't know any of this. How is it that some of the best read people in the United States don't know this history? And that's the sort of the amnesia, the destruction of memory that we're confronting. And so this book, what I'm trying to do in many ways is take a really dynamic, riveting tale of tyrants and spies and betrayals and armed battles and smuggle Mexican-American history into the center of the American story with that. So when you read about all these stories, you learn also about the rise of U.S. empire and global power. That begins in Mexico. You learn about a history of racial violence that's often untold here in the United States. You learn about immigration history that centers people arriving from south of the border rather than from Europe, which is so critical because as of 1980, Mexico became the dominant sending source for all immigrants in U.S. history to the United States, right? So more Mexicans that arrived than Germans or anybody else. It's a demographic revolution that has happened, but we don't have a history for that, right? And so people look like they're outsiders, that they haven't been coming for more than 100 years, building this nation, and that this nation and its empire did not structure their arrival, right, by the displacement and dispossession in Mexico. And you learn so much more, right? You learn about the FBI and all kinds of weird stuff. So this book is about addressing that amnesia that you're talking about, but because there's no keywords, there's no pillars in the U.S. history canon or mainstream for entering into Latinx history or Mexican history, I got to smuggle it and just give you a really awesome story to be able to penetrate some of those walls.
I mean, if smuggling a book is the best, that's like the best. That's like the best way I could. You know, and I'm just thinking, so here in Pilsen in Chicago is 100-year-old traditionally Mexican, American and Mexican neighborhood. And I just remember being in high school, going to punk rock shows in Pilsen, and people talking about their abuelitos, their abuelitas, who had memories of their own parents participating and donating and not only forming sort of what it would be leftist labor culture in Chicago, but it occurred to me when reading your book, it's like they were talking about their great-grandparents. Holy shit, this is what it is. And it took a kid like wandering into a punk rock show by accident to even get a sliver of that. So the whole concept of smuggling the real history into sort of the fake history or the written history that's forced on us is a powerful thing. And I really want to talk about, too, and I want to make sure we have time, because there was also a smuggling of words throughout this whole history. And essentially, everybody almost in this story, in this history, was reading Regeneración, this leftist, socialist call to arms newspaper that existed, that starting during this time. So everyone is reading it. Workers, organizers, strikers, revolutionaries, North American and Mexican leftists, but also the threatened capitalists were reading it. And federal law agents were reading it. And key, powerful political figures on both sides of the borders were reading Regeneración in these other magazines that popped in and out of existence during this period of time. Can you tell us, I was so fascinated with this, can you tell us a little bit about these leftist newspapers, Regeneración, and sort of what momentous role they played, sort of not only in quote-unquote sort of like educating about what was happening when strikers were being murdered, not only ways in which there were calls to revolutionary ideas and leftist ideas, but it was also used as an actual call to arms. And in the United States, it seems so much opposite of what we expect from our media, right? It seems we're not used to this idea that there is a really serious, powerful pillar called newspapers, right? Can you talk a little bit about sort of the role that these newspapers played in the lives of the revolutionaries and also in this extraordinary call to arms?
Sure. So let's talk about Regeneración, or Regeneration, which is their newspaper. But I also want to step back a little bit, because I know many of you may not know exactly what we're talking about, right? Yeah. So this book, Bad Mexicans, it tells the story of a group of Mexican dissidents who come to the United States in the early 20th century to try to incite a revolution back in Mexico against the dictator in Mexico. That dictator, his name was Porfirio Diaz. So they come to the United States, Texas, in 1904 to restart their rebel newspaper, Regeneración, to establish a political party. And in time, they come to establish an army, really, of the dispossessed that go on to raid Mexico. And as they're organizing in the United States, the U.S. and Mexican governments put together a cross-border counterinsurgency team to undercut their social movement before it could start a revolution in Mexico and oust Porfirio Diaz. And why would the United States care so much? That's the big question, right? So the United States, right, of course, had been charging across the North American continent throughout the 19th century. We complete the Transcontinental Railroad in 1876, and once we do that, U.S. investors, the robber barons, the folks who are building the railroad, they look up and they go, what's next, right? Where do we go next? And they look south and they find Porfirio Diaz, who had just taken power in Mexico by a coup d'etat, and he was this really powerful military general who had seized the presidency. And they begin to work with the Diaz regime, building railroads into Mexico that were first completed in, actually in 1885. And then this flood of U.S. investors goes into Mexico and begins buying up land, getting all kinds of kickbacks and concessions from the Diaz regime, building industries. So the U.S. investors come to dominate the oil industry in Mexico, the railroad industry in Mexico, and mining in Mexico, plus other industries. U.S. investors also, foreign investors overall, but U.S. investors in particular, come to own about a quarter of the Mexican land base during the Diaz regime. By the turn of the 20th century, 50% of all U.S. investments abroad are in Diaz's Mexico. So the idea that you had these revolutionaries who wanted to oust Porfirio Diaz, who was protecting all these investors, was scary and frightening to the United States government, because it would topple U.S. investments in Mexico. So that's why the U.S. government works with the Diaz regime to suppress Ricardo Flores Magón and his friends who were building this social movement. And so it's the story of, yes, their social movement, but also the cross-border counterinsurgency team and their efforts to stop the revolution before it could get started. And so I tell the story of how Ricardo Flores Magón and his friends rebuild this incredible rebel newspaper, Regeneración. They first do it in San Antonio, Texas, and then St. Louis, Missouri, and then Los Angeles, California. And it's a newspaper that really demonstrates the power of words, because on the front page of this newspaper, they would call out the fact that Diaz had, quote, made Mexicans the servants of foreigners. They would call out the fact that he had been a ruler for more than 20 years, 24 years, 25 years, and that democracy was absolutely broken in Mexico. Diaz didn't like any of this, right?
No dictators.
No
ever
dictator
liked
like that,
being...
right? The freedom of the press. And so he, you know, when they're in Mexico, he imprisons them multiple times. That's why they flee to come to the United States. But they are able to rebuild their newspaper and publish it from the United States. And part of this cross-border counterinsurgency team is they get the U.S. Postal Service to deny them second-class postage rights, so it gets really expensive for them to send their newspaper back to Mexico. So what do these rebels do? Do they give up? Oh, no, they don't, right? They start smuggling the newspaper back into Mexico. Migrant workers would take it with them. They would, you know, stuff it inside their shirts and take it with them from job to job to job. Literacy's not high, so they would read it to one another, right, by campfire, on a porch, in a cantina, in a bar, whatever, right? So it's the power of the oral tradition and the written word moving very quickly, especially throughout the borderlands. And so this newspaper really is part of the heart of the revolution, is the power of the written word against the big lie, right? That there's a democracy in Mexico, that everything's okay, and they're puncturing that lie every day.
And what's expressed too by you know, how absolutely afraid people were of press, you know, and how much they afraid were, how it could sort of change not only the ways in which people were organizing, but inform them specifically of how do we create this better, you know, world, or at least a world in which we can get our land and sort of our material dignity back. So I also have to say, There's like a paragraph in there, and I've been thinking about this paragraph. As a writer, I've been thinking about this paragraph a lot out of all these things, but there was a bookstore, La Aurora, in Los Angeles, and so, you describe it, it was a popular hangout, it was a bookstore in Los Angeles for the revolutionaries, the leftists, politicos in Los Angeles at the time, and immediately I was like, this is like, after dinosaurs, this is stop number two if I had a time machine. Like, I would want to, like, go to this bookstore and just, like, hang out. You know, and again, not only that, but it goes to show sort of the critical space created out of cities like Chicago and Los Angeles, where these newspapers, these people in these bookstores were vibrant forces for workers and vibrant forces for families in this community. So I don't have a question necessarily about the bookstore. I just wanted to sort of notate that the level of research and the level of sort of fascinating material that is enfolded into the lives of the people and things like the bookstores, the bookstore that you note is just a powerful reminder. These are real places in the United States with real people, real lives, real solidarities, tender or when they split. And it makes us realize how sort of pan-American this story is. And I think I'm really responding to the fact that what you're saying, in Mexico, these are known stories which have turned into known myths and nothing. You know, just to even know about this bookstore. I was like, I have to go like write a play about this bookstore now, right? Like, I was so fascinated with the fact that in American cities, this was happening and we didn't know about it. And I want to make sure to get to one really critical question that I thought about while reading all of this. And I kept thinking so many narratives are sort of buried beneath the ruin of like capital and empire. And one consistent thing I think where forced amnesia is really prevalent and aware is the erasure of workers and strikers, the absolute erasure of labor history in the United States. Is just so prevalent in our day-to-day lives. And you turn on any news source today, you go to those textbooks. Labor history is a notation, and yet it's formed the material realities that workers and families live in. So I just want to know, in what ways did labor organizing and strikes play a pivotal role in this revolution? Because we've been talking about individuals, but let's talk about the workers that made this happen. Labor strikes and laborers, in what ways did they absolutely change this history?
That's a great story as well. I remember when I was in graduate school, if you were learning labor history, it was all kind of the house of labor stuff. It was all labor unions and like rules, and it was really boring. Like, I didn't understand any of it. In this story, it's really about ordinary folks confronting power, often the edge of a gun, right? Yeah. That's what they're confronting. So there's one really important labor strike that I detail in this book, which I think is maybe what you're getting at. After Ricardo Flores Magón and the Magonistas come to the United States and they restart Regeneración and they start a political party, the PLM, El Partido Liberal Mexicano, PLM, they're kind of like, okay, what comes next, right? And there's a strike that happens in Mexico at a U.S.-owned copper mine just south of the border, about 30, 40 miles south of the border, in this town called Cananea, Mexico, in Sonora. And it's a really important labor strike because it was miners, or Mexican miners in this town, which is a company-owned town. They really live like in a valley, right? And they live in homes that they've built themselves from all the material that's left over from the mine. And up on a bluff above them in Mexico is where all the Anglo-American managers live. And they live in homes that are beautiful, that are built by the company. They've got a school, they've got churches, they've got, you know, nice streets and all of that. So you can really see the differences of their everyday lives. You also know that the people who live in the canyon below, it's called Ronquillo, are dying because most of the vapors from the mine are falling into their community and falling into their lungs, and they're dying at a rapid rate. And so the miners go on strike for a couple reasons. One, for their own health and well-being, but two, because Jim Crow ideas, occupational segregation in the United States, that's what the Anglo-American managers brought to Mexico, right? And so they said, Mexican miners, you stay down in the low-wage, dangerous mining positions. The managers will have higher paid jobs. So you have racially segregated workforce in the mines. And so the miners say, we want to fight for the betterment of our lives and our health. We also want to fight for access to better pay and better working conditions. Yeah. And they go on strike on June 1st of 1906 against this American-owned mine in Cananea, Mexico. They shut down the mines. They are marching up the hill to the company town. They go to the lumber yard at the company town where they want to recruit more Mexicans into the strike. And two of the Anglo-Americans who worked at the lumber yard, who are from Santa Barbara, California, say, "You're not coming in here and you're not talking to the miners." They say, "Yeah, we are coming in here and we're going to recruit our people into this strike." And a scuffle begins. A couple of the guards may have started shooting, or they started spraying with a fire hose, and very quickly all hell breaks loose and the lumber yard is set on fire. Several of the Mexican miners are shot and killed, and the two Anglo-American guards who have been guarding the lumber yard are dead with miner sticks in their backs. From that point on, the miners pick up their dead and they begin to march down the center of the company town. And the man who owned this company town had taken a midnight trip across the border just the evening before when he heard rumors that the strike was going to begin. And he bought all of these guns for his security forces with dum-dum bullets, you know, the kind that rip the flesh. And as the miners are going through the town, they just open fire on them and they kill, you know, dozens of people. They chase the miners back down in Ronquillo, fire on them there. And for a couple of hours, it was all chaos in Cananea, in which Anglo-American managers and a mine owner are massacring Mexican miners. And it's that strike, right, that really communicates to the whole Mexican population that there's a huge problem in Mexico. That U.S. investors come in and they create jobs, yes, but those jobs are often dangerous for Mexican workers. And when Mexican workers try to fight for higher wages and for a better condition of life, it became violent against them and they died.
Yeah.
And in fact, when that lumberyard went on fire in Cananea, remember, it's just like 30, 40 miles south of the border, Anglo-Americans in Arizona saw the fire, right? It's at nighttime. It's like licking the sky. And they put together a posse and they invade Mexico to go and shut down that strike. And it's that invasion of really a drunk white posse from Arizona that also frightens many Mexicans to say, yo, Porfirio Diaz can't even stop these vigilantes from coming south of the border to protect U.S. investors. How in the world is he going to stop another major U.S. invasion of the United States or of Mexico by the United States, such as the U.S.-Mexico War of 1846 to 1848? So that's a really important strike in the history of Mexico that helps turn the population toward the idea that, you know, maybe this Diaz regime thing is not so good for us. And it also helps to mobilize the Magonistas and bring many more people to their movement.
Hugely insightful, I think, just that fair. And I just want to add one quick more thing. In the conclusion, you know, you write, we have all paid a price for overlooking Latino history. And I sort of was just stopped dead in my tracks when I read that as a Latino. You know, Mexican revolutionaries and the revolution in Mexican lives didn't just change the United States. They defied amnesia and erasure, and they are the United States. You know, and a quick personal note, because we're talking about labor, my own abuelito in Ecuador, who passed away at 102, which is basically immortal, like a couple months ago, his name was Napoleon Zapata, so like impossible to live up to when it comes. But he was a farmer and he was a labor activist. And I've talked with him a lot about that. And it was just a couple months ago where I work at the School of the Art Institute and we unionized. The staff unionized and the Art Institute unionized. And I couldn't help but thinking there was this thread of his life in my own. Or when I talked with Caribbean and Afro-Caribbean and Latino co-workers about the unionization process, so many of them noted their parents, their grandparents, and this powerful idea of labor. And I just want to say thank you for seeing us and thank you for knowing us, because this is a history that we can connect with today. It's a history that's changing labor today. So thank you for this book, Bad Mexicans. Everyone, please, here's the nice thing about books. You could always smuggle a material object, but you'd be smuggling some ideas to take with you, which is even more even more critical. And these history of these revolutionaries. So thank you for writing this book, for seeing us, and for knowing us, even more importantly. So please, 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 everyone give Kelly Little Hernandez huge round of applause for coming to Chicago, for joining us. And absolutely go get that book. Go smuggle some thoughts. Thank you. Thank you, Kelly.
No, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo discusses her writing and her work with Marie Arana, an award-winning author and literary director of the Library of Congress. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.